This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 60 was recorded on April 27th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. We received a huge number of listener requests to get Martin Armstrong in the program, and Patrick was finally able to catch up with him. We'll be discussing the U.S. dollar, why Martin is bullish on the stock market, and much more. And speaking of listener requests, we've noticed a growing trend recently where we're getting all kinds of requests to interview guests that we've already interviewed about topics that we've already discussed with them. For example, just last week we received several requests to get Professor Steve Keen on the program to discuss his debt jubilee proposal. Now, we've already interviewed Professor Keen about that subject, so we're not going to do that again. We do have Professor Keen scheduled to come back on the program next week, but we're going to be covering other stuff. And similarly, we've also received multiple requests to get Jim Rickards on the program for the first time, and we've already interviewed him right after his most recent book came out. So I want to encourage our newer listeners to check out the wealth of information in our past episodes. All 60 of them are still available free of charge from our homepage at macrovoices.com, and most of those feature interviews are as relevant now as the day they were recorded.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Now, Eric, let's take a look at that S&P 500. The French elections came in, and obviously the market got what it wanted, and we saw that big, huge gap higher in the S&P with the follow-through up to this around the 2385 level. What's your feeling on the S&P here?
Well, it's pretty much as we predicted. If there was a relatively clear outcome to the French elections, and I think the Macron victory is pretty clear, that pretty much sets us up for another excuse for people to buy stocks. I definitely don't think that these valuations are really justified by the fundamentals, but I won't be at all surprised if we see an upside breakout, and who knows, we'll be talking about 24-something next week on the program. I do think the market is overvalued, but we've gotten some good feedback from our listeners saying, hey, we've got too many guests that all have this bearish view. We really need a credible bull argument. Well, we've got one for you this week because Martin Armstrong thinks that valuations could double from here. Stock valuations could double from here. And what's fascinating is he doesn't disagree with me that we're already in overvalued territory. He just thinks that the capital flows and investor sentiment setup is such that we could see a doubling before this thing is over. So we're going to get into a lot more detail. I don't want to steal Mr. Armstrong's fire, so to speak. We'll save the rest of that for the feature interview.
All right. Well, let's take a look at that U.S. dollar index, which obviously the euro popped on the French elections, and the U.S. dollar index headed down toward that 99 handle. And underneath, we've really flatlined after the big gap move. Where do you think the U.S. dollar index is going next?
I still see the bullish case for the dollar, and I think that we're seeing a lot of jawboning lower, but in terms of actual policy, we should probably see a resumption of this rally. The thing is, I'm really happy to have followed Julian Brigden's advice a few weeks ago. If I look at the chart, it just plain looks ugly. And if we do start to see an unwind below 98, and particularly 97.50, that could get into, everybody being stopped out of the trade at the same time, and it could potentially take us much lower. I do want to be longer term, but I'm glad to be sitting this dance out, so to speak. I should note, however, that we did receive a opposing view from one of our listeners, so I definitely encourage you to check your research roundup for the bearish view that's expressed by one of our listeners.
All right, Eric. Well, let's take a look at that crude oil, and there's no other way to summarize it other than maximum volatility, where we swing all the way down to the 47 handle, swing all the way up towards 53, 54, and all the way back down to 48. It's just a roller coaster ride. Where do you think we go next here?
Well, and today was a roller coaster day in the bigger picture of a larger roller coaster. So let's recount what's happened since last week's show. I predicted that you would see a continued sell-off down to the 200-day moving average, which is right around $49 right now. I predicted there would be some support and that then there would be a further sell-off. Well, that's exactly what happened. We saw the sell-off to the 200-day moving average. The market was hovering at that level, waiting for inventory. What we saw in the inventory report on Wednesday this week was a big and unexpected drawdown in national crude oil inventories, 3.6 million barrels, 1.2 million of that was from Cushing, Oklahoma. Well, that's obviously a bullish signal, and it sent the market screaming higher. Well, wait a minute. There's more. Who used to say that? Ron Popeil? But wait, there's more. Gasoline, 3.4 million barrel build on inventory. Unexpected large build. Distillates, 2.7 million barrel build. So if you net this all out, it was actually a build on total petroleum inventories this week, even though the headline crude number was a big negative number. And yes, production was up again, quite predictably, as we've discussed on the show previously. So I was planning to say rhetorically on this program, well, I wonder if we're really going to see this big screaming move to the upside continue, or if it's going to turn into a dead cat bounce. The market beat me to it. Early on Thursday morning, we took out the 200-day moving average decisively. And I thought, boy, that coming less than 24 hours after what a lot of people interpreted as a very bullish inventory report, that really says something. $47 is next. That's the next key support level. And boy, it's really going to get ugly if we take that out. But brace for impact, folks. We're headed lower. Then this afternoon, boy, we touched down to, what was it, 48 spot 20 was the low at about 11:30 a.m., and we have retraced all of that, closing this afternoon above that 200-day moving average at $49. We're looking at 49 spot 18 as we're taping the show, just coming up on the close here. So I think a technician could argue, hey, that was a reversal candle. It's time to buy here. It's a bullish sign. I don't think the fundamentals are lined up for that, but I was definitely surprised by the strength of that recovery. I think in the next couple of days, you're going to see a big move one way or the other. The case I'm favoring is that we take out both the 200-day moving average at 49 and channel support just below that. We need to see a close, not just intraday action like we had today, but a close below about 48 spot 75 or so. And I think that really is the bearish signal that much lower prices are coming. But it didn't happen today after all. It looked like it did. And then late session, we saw a very impressive retracement. So I'll be watching the chart very carefully to see what comes next. Do want to mention also a viewpoint that I think is very interesting. This comes from an analyst called Bryn Kelly, who you can follow her on Twitter at Bryn K. Kelly. Very, very bright analyst, and she has observed that what nobody's paying attention to is refinery utilization is just about maxed out now. We're at almost 100% refinery utilization because there has been strong demand for export of petroleum products as well as domestically, and everybody's jumping for joy. Well, hey, wait a minute, folks. We've got this storage problem, and so far we're kind of drawing down on storage, even if only a little bit. Well, if you get to the point where refineries are maxed out and they cannot increase their refining because they're already at their maximum productivity, that means that there's a knock-on effect where you could see storage starting to pile up again. So watch refinery utilization carefully for that knock-on effect of potentially resulting in unexpected further builds on crude oil inventory.
All right, Eric, thanks for that update. I want to move on to gold, though. Now, what's interesting is that the natural intermarket relationship would be that with that U.S. dollar breakdown that we should have actually seen gold tick up. But we now clearly are seeing almost this risk-off, risk-on scenario. Now that the French elections happen, suddenly gold kind of starts selling. What do you think's in store for gold here?
Well, as we've discussed the last couple of weeks, you've got to consider geopolitical risk is already priced in. And, you know, French election over with, Le Pen didn't win. That is creating a headwind for gold. I think that you may see in coming weeks a de-escalation of the North Korean and Syrian situations. And if that happens, I think gold is headed lower. I would expect maybe 1220 or so. I do think the bottom is in. I missed that one. That's too bad. It looks like for now the dollar index is maybe weakening. But I think that the geopolitical risk that was already priced into gold is a bigger factor than the U.S. dollar. And that geopolitical risk is starting to come back out of the market, as at least slightly it's abating. Yeah, okay, we've still got Donald Trump threatening to maybe blow a country off the face of the earth with nuclear weapons. But let's just overlook that for now.
All right. Well, now that we're on the theme of risk on, risk off, the Treasury bonds played into that storyline perfectly. Now, right after that French election, we were trading down around that 220 handle on the interest rates, and now we've found ourselves trading near 230. Where do you think interest rates are going next here on the 10-year Treasury?
Yeah, you know, I saw that move back above 2.3% with rates backing back up. I think we closed today lower than that, but for most of the morning anyway, it was above 2.3% on the 10-year. And I don't think the down move is over yet, but I was curious. I touched base with Juliet DeClercq today, asked her whether or not she's still advising her clients to stay long treasuries. She said, yes, she is. She thinks this is a hiccup and that we're still going to see lower yield. I think 2% is the next major number to test, and we really have to see what happens with the economic cycle, what happens with the Trump tax plan, what happens with healthcare and so forth, and where the economy is going to stand. If we head into another recession, then certainly I think lower rates are coming. But, you know, we don't know that yet. Before you move on, though, to the guest interview, I want to encourage everyone to be sure to stay tuned after the feature interview, because Patrick is going on a speaking tour in Western Canada, and we're going to give you all the details right after my interview with Martin Armstrong.
Well, thank you, Eric. And let's move on to the interview. Now, Martin Armstrong is the president of Armstrong Economics and operates an active news blog that focuses on the global economy. Eric's interview with Martin Armstrong is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at MacroVoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Martin Armstrong from Armstrong Economics. And Martin, thanks so much for coming on the program. I'm particularly interested to get your views on equities because we've had so many bearish guests. We've been looking for someone with a well-considered and intelligent bull view to counter that. But before we go there, why don't we start with the U.S. dollar? Because I think that some of the international capital interactions are going to play into your equity view. So what do you see in the U.S. dollar? Some people are saying it's rolling over, the rally done. Other people are saying it's just taking a pause.
No, it's just basically in a temporary pause right now because of the French elections. You have people that are just, you know, diehard pessimists, and you have other people that are optimists. And in the case of the euro, the optimists, it's more like, I used to have an old professor who explained the difference between the two. He says, they're on top of the World Trade Center and a good wind blows them off. He says, the pessimist immediately starts praying. The optimist, as he's passing the fourth floor, says, well, so far, so good. And that's pretty much what it is with the euro. These people, you know, Le Pen, you know, loses, the euro will come back. Why is the euro down to begin with? It is basically a structural flaw. You have Schwab now actually arguing that the euro zone should be separate and distinct from the EU. And it's effectively, the problem is when the euro was being founded, they actually came to us first. And they took at our conference in London, they took the whole back row. I met with them and I explained to them, I said, look, the only way the dollar is going to be, you're going to be able to compete against the dollar would be to consolidate all the debts. And then you would have a federal debt. That's how an institution is going to pick up the phone and say, okay, fine, yeah, buy me $2 billion, whatever. I mean, they need a place to park the money. And I was told right up front that basically they just wanted to get the currency through first. The debts, they didn't think that they would get the Europeans to vote for it because it would look like a bailout for Southern Europe. And I said, well, if you don't do it, you're going to bail them out anyhow. Well, that would be phase two. They never got to phase two. Now, think of the euro this way. I mean, if the United States didn't have a federal debt and the banks used the debt of all 50 states as the reserve and Mississippi goes down, everybody would be scrambling, oh, well, who has most of Mississippi bonds? Let's short that bank. You know, this is what Europe is. The ECB has 40% of all the government debts within Europe. Banks had to be politically correct and have a piece of everybody. They couldn't just have one. That would be not fair. So the problem is Greece starts getting into trouble, Italy, Spain. Now you're chopping away the bank reserves. This is why the European banking system, honestly, a good stiff wind is going to blow it over. And this is part of the entire, you know, strength to, you know, behind the dollar. The euro idea came from the Plaza Accord. That's when the dollar went up and the pound went to 103. And that was Jim Baker saying, listen, we have to have something else to compete against the dollar. Why don't you people all join together and create a single currency for Europe? They took the idea and they ran. But they didn't do it properly. And this is the whole problem. So you have, the ECB and everybody jumping on Italy right now, and Italy's got to raise taxes to meet this criteria that they've established in Brussels, and you have a disparity between all the different economies. It just does not work. So Le Pen losing is really the death blow to the euro, because these people are going to, oh, yeah, that's great, buy the euro, but there's nothing there. It will turn around and collapse. The euro is going down below par. There's no question about it. There's no way to sustain this thing. You have unemployment in the South among the youth at 60%. The Great Depression here was 25%. I mean, it's a total disaster. And these people, the newspapers keep trying to support the press. What they're doing, they're trying to support the politicians here, and by constantly cheering and putting out this fake news stuff. And it's just not, you can talk it up a tree all you want, but that's it. It's not staying there.
So it sounds like you share a view that we've heard from a lot of people, which is that the European Union is probably in pretty serious trouble here, and probably Brexit was the beginning of the end. Is that the way you see this playing out, or am I putting too many words in your mouth?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was there for the Greek elections. I was there in Barcelona. I mean, I've been basically talking to a number of different governments around, and it behind the curtain, I'm telling you, they're all just being pushed to their limits. And even Schwab has now finally come out and said Greece should withdraw from the euro. And I posted on our blog, we took the government's own GDP statistics. The peak in GDP from Great Britain was 1973. It's been nothing but a downhill move ever since then, once they joined the EU. You have a tremendous amount of regulations, and they regulate everything beyond belief. And it's really pretty bad, because you have, a lot of bureaucrats there in Brussels that are totally disconnected from everything. The structure of Brussels is basically an anti-democratic organization. We hear about the Troika. Okay, fine. That's the head of the IMF. She doesn't stand for any election. You have Mario Draghi, head of the ECB, is never elected. Then you have the head of the EU, who is basically appointed by other people. There is no way the European people have a right to vote against anything that's going on in Brussels. There's no democratic process whatsoever. So if you're mad and you can't go to the polls to get rid of these people. And this is the frustration that's building up. And, you know, it's everywhere. You go to Germany. In southern Germany, they say, no, we're Bavarian first, German second. It's France. It's the same thing. You go to Spain, Italy, I'm hearing it. Everywhere you go, it's just like people are fed up, and that you can't make it if you're going to deny a democratic process, which is what Brussels has done, then what is the other thing? The other thing are elections like this, and if that fails and they still can't get, any kind of reform out of this, you end up with revolutions and stuff. It's really disastrous. But Brexit should have put Brussels on notice. Hey, what are we doing wrong? Let's look at this. No, instead they want to punish Brussels. Brussels just wants to punish Britain. And then what happens is that they are then threatening anybody else that there wants to follow in their footsteps. So, this is not the way to run a country, really. So this is part of the strength behind the dollar.
Let's, with that in mind, come back to the U.S. equity market now, because I remember more than a year ago hearing you interviewed, and I thought that the bullish case that you made was a lot more intelligent than others that I heard, not so much about everything's rosy in the economy, but rather international capital flows because things are worse other places were likely, you thought, to drive continued strength in equities and the dollar. Both of those things have definitely come true, so congratulations on the call. But bring us up to date. What's the whole thesis, and where do we stand now? And this thing's gone an awfully long way. Is it too long in the tooth, or is there more to go in terms of this equity rally?
Now we're... you're back at testing the highs again. this is what people don't understand. The vast majority always has to be wrong. So most of your people out here are bearish on the stock market. Oh, it's a record highs, et cetera. Just, peel it back and look a little bit. The Gallup polls show that retail participation in this market's at historic lows. It has not come back. All right. So what's happening? And when we advise internationally, we're not just a domestic analyst type thing. So we actually have to deal with the corporations and institutions around the world, as well as a number of governments. And this is how capital moves. And I was a hedge fund manager for a long time, and this is really what happens. When Greece fell in 2010, all right, what did the traders do on institutional desks? They immediately looked around and said, oh, that was a good trade. Who's next? They're all like this. Oh, Portugal. Then they draw some blood from there. Then they go to Spain. Oh, Italy next. Oh, look at France. This is the way capital moves, okay? This is big money, all right? So we're looking at here, these people keep saying, oh, the Dow's going to crash, et cetera. All right, fine. They're just domestic people. They're just looking at charts, and that's all. They don't know anything about the fundamentals behind this, all right? And the Dow has been leading because Dow is basically the trophies. That's where big international money goes. Next, you have the S&P. A lot of domestic institutions, broaden it out using the S&P. Then you have the NASDAQ, which is more retail-oriented. All right. When the Dow is leading, this is the big money coming. When Japanese came in for real estate, what did they buy? They bought the trophies, Rockefeller Center. The Chinese do the same thing. They always go for the trophies. All right, so what you want to be concerned about is when the NASDAQ is breaking out and making new highs ahead of everything else. So now it's more retail. But in order to get a crash, you have to have an excessive bullishness, and that is not anywhere close to the present situation. You've had basically the Dow take off for, with the French elections, and Trump is still talking about, tax cuts. And big money realizes government is in trouble. All right. And you look across the board, the debts are astronomical. I mean, people think, U.S. has got $20 trillion. So you hear about, buy gold, all this other kind of stuff. $20 trillion is nothing. The global, debt is $150 trillion. Now take the emerging markets. The emerging markets splurged. The dollar, basically interest rates were going down, so they borrowed a lot more than they should have. The emerging market debt is about half that of the United States, and they don't have the economy to support it. So if you want a crisis, which a lot of these people keep talking about, if you lower the dollar, as Trump would like to see, that's not going to be a crisis. They'll be cheering, and they'll borrow more. The only way to get a crisis going, and you're going to look at monetary reform coming out, probably going into 2020, is for the dollar to go up, not down. If the dollar goes up, now you're looking at a situation of that's when the crisis, really comes to a head. It was the dollar going up in the Great Depression that sparked FDR to then confiscate gold and devalue the dollar, etc. It was the dollar that went up into 1985, and the pound went to par, all right? That sparked the Plaza Accord, the creation of the G5. You don't get these things if the dollar goes down, only when the dollar goes up. So all these people keep talking about the end of the world and all this stuff, and the dollar is going to crash. Sorry, the dollar's got to go up first to create the crash. That will put everybody else in absolute terrible position. And then as the debt goes up, all right, and what happens is the Fed, also with the stock market going up, the Fed will make the same mistake it always does. It will keep raising interest rates to try and chase the market to stop it. And you can look between 1927, 1929. All right, same thing happened. The capital flows came here. The dollar basically started, taking off. What did the Fed do? They doubled interest rates. The Dow doubled. The more they raise the interest rates, more people who aren't necessarily buying the stock market from overseas are going to look at it and say, gee, I can earn a lot more money in the dollar. I'll go over there. So the higher you raise the interest rates, the more capital you'll attract. Even this issue with excessive reserves. I mean, we have, we heard so much, we're going to get hyperinflation. The Fed's got a $4 trillion balance sheet. Very nice. Okay, but the Fed also created excess reserve because the banks basically complained they didn't have any money to, any place to put the money. How much it went into excess reserves? Almost $3 trillion. The money never went out. Okay, it's nice to think, just look at the quantity of money and that should be inflationary. No, that's not the way it works. You got to spend it. If you're not spending it, you're not lending it, then you're not going to create the inflation. And that's the same thing that's happening in Europe. It's deflation. They've increased the money supply. They don't understand. If you're increasing the money supply, in theory, inflation, but you're raising taxes. The net bottom line is how much do you have at the end of the day in your pocket? I mean, they're not actually increasing the net disposable income. Now, if Trump lowers the taxes, as he's now saying, and that goes through, you're going to have a lot more money coming in from overseas. Any American corporation that doesn't bring back their money at this point in time, should be a short. eBay wanted to take over a company domestically. They would have had to bring back cash from overseas. They looked at the tax being 40% on top of everything else, and they backed out of the deal. It was too expensive. Lower that to 10%, they'll bring that money back. And it's basically you're going to see a lot more boom in the economy. And despite what, you know, the politicians, you know, that always want to say, oh, raising taxes helps the rich or whatever. The biggest, you know, holders in the stock market are basically pension funds. So it doesn't really help the rich. It helps everybody. But, you know, it, you know, they basically like to put out an agenda. But this, when the first person to lower taxes, that was JFK. That created a big boom into 66. Okay, when Reagan came in, lowered taxes, that basically took the stock market off from 85 all the way out, broke new highs. All right, it's what you, you know, people don't understand, but it's always the net. We've done studies on interest rates, et cetera, in the stock market. And it's total nonsense that raising interest rates is bearish for the stock market. the stock market has never peaked with the same level of interest rates twice. And what it is, it's the net differential. If you think the stock market's going to double, you'll be willing to pay 25% interest. If you think it's only going to go up 1%, you won't pay 1%. So it's what you think. It's expectations. If you think you're going to make 5%, you'll pay 1%. But you're not going to pay 5%, 6%, 7%, or 10%. So it's the tail end when they finally raise interest rates high enough that exceeds expectations of the future. That's when everything backs off. But there's no particular level it's ever reached twice that causes a decline. So the stock market is still going to go up.
So you think that the what we've gotten to already has been driven mostly by international capital flows for basically because the rest of the world is hurting worse than we are. You think that we're not set up to see a big crash, as some people have suggested, because of a lack of retail participation. So do you therefore expect that that retail participation is coming? They just haven't piled in yet? Or do you think that people are so burned from 2008 that they're still afraid of the market?
Well, it is a combination. They're not in because they were burned from 2007. secondly, if the tax cuts do go through, you're going to see a lot more people. And I would say, honestly, the Dow is in solid territory as long as it continues to hold above 20,000 on a monthly closing basis. I mean, if you just look at the chart, I mean, compare it to 29 or 66 or any of the major highs. There's an old rule we have from basically trading, and that is, you know, markets are very unforgiving. They give you one opportunity, and that's it. Okay, 1929, 1989, Japan, whatever. It gives you one shot to sell the high, not 20, 30 times. If it's going to give you that many times, it's not the high. Sorry. You look at this, all right, the Dow, we're back, you know, basically nearly at the high again. We're in the 21 zone. But the market has gone sideways, all right? It's building a base still at higher levels. So we're not close to this. And the retail participation our models are showing will start to come in when the Dow exceeds about 23,000. When it does that, now you're in a position where you can get into what we call a phase transition. That's where a market will double very, very rapidly. And it tends to be short-lived. And this is the way things trade in everything. I mean, for example, gold going into 1980. All right, went from $100 in 1976. It finally reached $400. All right, by mid-December 1979. What everybody remembers is gold going to, you know, to the 800. It did that in the last 6 weeks. It doubled the last 6 weeks. That's what you're looking for. That's what we call phase transition. The same thing with the Nikkei. The same thing with the Dow. You look at, and there's almost, you know, at least a third to a doubling effect in the shortest amount of time. Now you're talking about that's the high. All right, it's an exhaustive move, and we're not anywhere close to that yet. Once we exceed 23, now you're going to start getting people in involved, and then you have a shot at one of those phase transitions. And it can go up into the mid 30 zone to even 40,000 before you then get a crack. But that would then force the Fed to come in and constantly try and stop it. They're going to be calling it an asset bubble. But what is the downside of this? As the Fed raises interest rates to try and stop an asset bubble, it then blows out the budgets of all the governments. All right? They're like a heroin junkie or something. I mean, the whole problem with the system and why we're really going ahead to a major monetary crisis is since World War II, these governments just borrow and borrow year after year. They never pay anything back. The premise of the Fed is, okay, fine, and central banks, we're going to raise interest rates to stop people from borrowing. Does it ever stop government? Never. They just keep chugging along. Lowering these interest rates to try and stimulate the economy stimulated the government. You look at it. I mean, everybody was beside themselves in 1980 when in the Reagan era, and the national debt hit $1 trillion. They said, oh, my God. Since 2007, basically the budgets have increased by at least a third, and we're looking at over $1 trillion annually now. So how is this going to stop? I mean, it reaches a point where it just simply goes bust. And historically, that point comes when it's just a Ponzi scheme in that the government issues new debt to pay off the last debt, and it keeps rolling it this way. When it crashes, what happens? They come out with the new debt, and there's no bid. When there's no bid, that's when there's the problem. That's what we're heading to. But we have major institutions that have figured this out. One very, very major pension fund, they actually did what we told them to do, get rid of all government debt, because effectively government debt is not secured, and when it goes bust, it just goes bust. If you own corporate debt, IBM or Google or whatever you want, and what happens is if they go bankrupt, you at least get something back. They sell off assets, et cetera. With the government, what can you do? Nothing. You can't go down to the National Gallery and start lifting Picassos. So that's the difference between government and private debt. So there's one pension fund that we advised. They sold all their government debt, and they moved to corporate debt. S&P came in and said, oh, you're taking on more risk. They showed them our study, and they said that they went and conducted their own study and verified what I'm saying is absolutely correct. All right. There has been no major default of a AAA corporate, ever, really. And you have government debt routinely defaults. All the time. It's never, ever been paid off. Governments go broke all the time. This is how it would happen. So they said, where are we taking on more risk? Because we're holding the cream of the crop of corporate that's actually backed. So government debt's not backed by anything. It's just by politicians and their promises and a lot of hot air. So you have people shifting. And you see the bonds are going down, the equities have been holding up, the smart money's beginning to move out of the bond markets and into the equity side. The ECB owns 40% of all the government debt in Europe. And the Europe basically starts to break up. The ECB is really in desperate position here. What do they have? They have nothing. All they can do is just rant and rave. They can't ever sell that debt again. So all they can do is sit there and hope that it pays off to reduce their balance sheet. That's it. The same thing with the Fed. The Fed has come out and bluntly stated that they're not going to reinvest what on their balance sheet. As it matures, they're going to let it mature and take back the cash and reduce the balance sheet. They can't sell that debt.
Some people have argued that we're really stuck in a pickle now because with so much debt, $20 trillion of Treasury debt now, they can't materially raise interest rates back towards historical norms because the government wouldn't be able to afford to service the debt that's already on the books. How do you feel about that view, and how do you see this playing out? Do we eventually get to a crisis in the Treasury market when there's no bid, or do they just keep printing more money? What happens next?
Well, I mean, that view is kind of very childish, I would say, in the sense that, one, it assumes that government is of one mind and one direction. It is more like a tribe, all right? You have SEC has its own lobbyists, so is the CFTC. They all lobby against each other. The Fed has to raise interest rates. The stock market goes up. You know, you're going to have the Fed has to now go before Congress and testify. The Democrats are going to be churning it. I mean, they're absolutely frying them and saying, see, you're making the rich all get, you know, richer, getting richer, blah, blah, blah. They have no concept of what they're doing with the national debt. I mean, people give way too much credit to these institutions in government. I mean, 2007 when the crash came, I mean, I got a call from the banking committee, House Banking Committee, and they wanted me to explain why did Lehman crash in 24 hours. I said, repo. I'm not joking. What was asked? They said, what's that? I said, what you regulate? Oh, we do? They don't know. These are politicians, they're lawyers, they're career people. They have no experience in markets whatsoever. They have no experience in economics. And all they do is vote for whatever it is that, you know, the next election's about. I've worked with governments, not just the U.S., with China, with all around the world. And for 40 years, this is the bottom line. You can go into a government and say, listen, you know, it's very nice what you've just said, you know, oh, interest rates go up. They'll say, yeah, okay, fine. They're not going to ever act. People say, oh, you know, government advisors, they take, you know, they don't do what you're ever asked to do, what you tell them to do. They won't do it. And this is my essence of it. If I was going to run for president, and I said to you, vote for me because I saved your job, you're going to look at me and say, well, how did I know I was going to lose it? You could just be saying that. It's better for you to lose your job. Then I say, okay, fine, vote for me. I'll go get the guy that did it. That's how politics works. They're reactionary. They do not ever prevent a crisis. Every crisis has always been created by government. You know, you take the 2007, you know, the mortgage-backed securities. All right. There were seven agencies that had to approve that. How does it work? You go to the second one. You got through the first one, the SEC. You go to the next one. Oh, did they approve it? Yeah. Oh, okay, fine, then we will. Nobody wants to be the odd man out. They don't even know what they're approving. They don't understand the markets. So you're expecting these people to actually analyze something? Good luck. They all go to the SEC or CFTC to get, you know, to make a name for themselves, to get a high-paying job on the private side. That's it. To sell influence. It was the same thing with Hillary, with her, you know, her foundation. You know, oh, it's really to help people. And as soon as she lost the election, everybody withdrew the money. It's all about influence. This is standard operational procedure in Washington, and it doesn't matter who you're talking about. They all do it that way. Right down to the bureaucrats.
I'd like to shift gears now because I know that you do a lot of international geopolitical risk analysis. And holy cow, look at what's going on between North Korea, China, Russia, threats of escalation of the Syria situation. Russia has actually warned the United States that they will respond with force if there's a repeat of the missile attack, which they consider to be completely unjustified on Syria. How do you see all of these situations? What's the most important one to be worried about? How do you think that things are going to unravel from here?
Well, I mean, I think the real wild card is Korea, and that's mainly because you have somebody who's totally inexperienced, who's on some power trip, and he has no concept of anything rational whatsoever. So he is the ultimate, you know, the two-year-old with the hammer and the TV set. You know, that's basically him. Syria is a different situation in that the whole thing was always about nothing more than really a pipeline. That was it. Qatar wanted to basically run a pipeline through there to compete with Russia to get gas to Europe. And Syria said no. And then you have in the Golan Heights, which is Syria but occupied by Israel, you have discoveries of oil which are bigger than Saudi Arabia. And the company that has technically the contracts to it is Genie Oil out of New Jersey. And who's on the board over there? Well, Dick Cheney. So if you really want to expand that, what are you going to do? You're going to overthrow the Syrian government. So all this nonsense about chemical warfare, et cetera, a lot of it has been done by the very rebels that we have supported. And the confrontation over there is really, really stupid. I'm disappointed in Trump for even doing what he did. I think he did basically to placate the neocons. But, I mean, and people like, you know, John McCain, I mean, he'd invade Canada if he could. I mean, there's no place on earth that he wouldn't like to invade to get back at for you know, his indignity and having to be, you know, to give up the United States and being, you know, one of those people all, you know, reading messages and stuff on the radio back there for the Vietnamese. But Syria is just a real quagmire, and you know, we have done nothing but nation building. That's what Trump initially said, there'll be no more nation building, and here he is, he's got his foot right in the mud over there again. And unfortunately, the downside of all this is the fact that it was the elections, in that instead of the Democrats accepting responsibility for all the leaks that came out of the emails from the DNC, what are they doing? They rather say, oh, it was Russia interfering with our election. Nobody says that Russia faked any of those emails, altered any of them, or put out any news that was not correct. You know, what they're saying is that they were lying to everybody, their emails got hacked, and the truth came out, and that's somehow not fair. And so they want to blame Russia for that. So you have this, oh, we have to investigate Russia, you know, interfered with our elections, and that's why Trump won. It's not true. But it then creates the dynamics in Washington where you have these Democrats that have demonized Putin. And it's ironic, but they were the ones that are actually, you know, trying to push for war, for retribution for Hillary losing the election. So it's really a crazy situation, and the Democrats are doing more harm, I think, to the nation than anybody realizes. But, I mean, this is not the old world. I mean, China and Russia have no interest in invading the United States and occupying this country. You know, communism is gone. Okay, they're not trying to put, you know, we're going to conquer the world and make everybody communist or whatever. That philosophy is dead. All right. So what are we into? We're into a world of just basically pushing buttons and retribution. That's it. So it's more like, you know, a divorce and throwing, you know, dishes at each other or something. But it's not, you know, the old model of conquest. That's kind of gone. So we really should reassess everything. You know, I've been in Washington. I've asked, I said, you know, why is Russia our enemy? And I said, if they're no longer communists, they're no, and nobody knows. They just say, well, the Russians. Okay, so, all right, the Russians. Why is China our enemy? Well, because they always used to be. There, nobody articulates any particular philosophy anymore. I mean, before it was communism and they're going to dominate the world, etc. Okay, that's all gone. So I would be more concerned about Korea, because there it's not an issue of economics. It's not an issue of anything but a young kid with basically a hammer and a TV. And hopefully somebody will try to assassinate him within his own government. But as long as he's still above, the high ranking on the power side, a lot of people will be afraid to do that because they don't know if the other ones will gang up on them. So you have to reach a level of tension where the second tier begins to question whether or not they really want to go to war. Because this guy will send everybody into war. There's no question about it. That's more dangerous. In the sense of Syria, it's more of the Democrats trying to get retribution against Russia. So I would like to think that Trump can at least see what's going on and back off a little bit over there. But, the Middle East is just a real quagmire. It's we've created the mess after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, carving everything up. We created these kingdoms, and this has all been, the downside of nation building.
While we're on mentioning China, I want to touch on the explosion of debt there that's occurred since 2008. Kyle Bass has obviously had a very outspoken view that it would be a Chinese debt crisis that could force a revaluation of the yuan and potentially send a wave of deflation around the globe. Do you agree with that view? Do you think he's onto something? How do you see the situation in China resolving?
Well, this is, China went down the road of basically the private sector went a little bit too far into the debt side. And, I've been to both Russia and China. And the difference between the two forms of communism was Russia was more Stalinistic in the sense that if he thought you even had the potential to be a revolutionary, he killed you. All right, he worried about what you thought. I had friends in East Germany that, when the wall came down, they found microphones hidden in their walls of their house. And over in China, basically, it was a different type of communism. It was they didn't seek to destroy humanity. In that sense, it was more of was called the tall poppy syndrome. The poppy that grows taller than the rest gets its head cut off. If you kept your mouth shut and your opinions to yourself, they didn't care. Whereas in Russia, it was like, if your parents speak bad against the government, turn them in because the government is really your real parent. So it was a completely different philosophy. That's why Russia has not boomed like China boomed. Once China was free, they just went, crazy. So the debt problems in China are, quite extensive. But this is part of the whole issue of like Bitcoin, etc. The bulk of the transactions were all in China. And it was basically just being used as a means to get the money out. And Chinese have been buying real estate and equities and everything else, getting the money out of China. They're quite extensive in the U.S. stock market. So, they're not interested basically in selling the stocks and going back to China or buying U.S. debt. So I do see a problem with China in the sense of a short-term deflation, but deflation's already in place globally. It's we are holding up the world economy right now. So people, you know, keep harping about the U.S. and $20 trillion. We are the only thing holding everything up. It is so bad outside the country, it, you know, people just are have blinders on. So, I mean, our economic growth is a fraction of what it was, you know, 20 years ago. And we're cheering. Oh, this is great. You know, Fed's targets of 2% for inflation. I mean, I remember when we were looking at 20% inflation. So, you know, I would say that it's more of this is the final phase transition for the equity side. It's when people are looking at the problem is in government debts. Where do you put your money? You know, this is why, you know, India canceled, you know, currencies. They're trying to eliminate the $100 bill. They're, you know, and that's just marginally here in the States. They're, you know, in Europe, everywhere, the battle cry is eliminate cash because it does two things. One, it prevents people from doing a bank run. I mean, how do you go down to the bank and take your money out? So, you know, put it on a CD-ROM. And the other side of this coin is basically that they think by eliminating tax, the currency, they're going to be able to get every penny of tax that they're entitled to. And this is why I say government is pretty pathetic in the sense I've met with these people and their view is very distorted. They never see themselves as the problem. There are no mirrors in Washington. All right. They only see you, never themselves. So their view is if they raise, they eliminate currency, then you can't hoard any money. And so therefore, they get every penny of tax. And this is the philosophy and was put out at the G20 meeting. And this is what India is trying to bring India up to that standard, eliminating cash. So where do you put your money? You can't put it in cash. If you're afraid of government, you don't want to buy government bonds. All right, state and municipal bonds, I mean, I'm telling you right now, you better get rid of them. Because honestly, you know, once one municipal starts going, you're going to see that as a contagion. Other municipals are going. Even if you have a municipal bond that is rock solid, it will still be discounted because all the rest of them are. So you don't want to be in that sort of stuff. The only place left is equities. That's it. I mean, sure, you can buy some gold for the individual, but institutions, they can't necessarily buy gold bars and stick them in the basement. You know, institutions, they're buying the equity side.
Well, I'd love to continue this conversation, Martin, but unfortunately we are out of time. Before we go, you operate a blog at armstrongeconomics.com. Please tell our listeners what they can expect to find there and also about the conferences that you produce.
Well, basically we cover the world economy, et cetera, on the blog. It's free. We do it more as a public service. That's armstrongeconomics.com. And our conferences are mainly really for professionals. I mean, they're not. Every once in a while, we do one for a retail audience, but more on the professional side. So those seats tend to go for like $2,500 up. Our next one of those are in Hong Kong by the end of the month, and then around November we do one in Orlando. So we also have a computer, which you can access. That's like $20 a month, and it's the only fully functioning artificial intelligence system. The computer like writes the actual reports. So that's covering. Right now, we have about 500 securities. It analyzes and puts writes a report on every individual security around the world. We're getting ready to expand that to about 5,000 probably by the end of the summer.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for your time today. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
You know, Eric, those were some really interesting insights from Martin Armstrong. You know, he his bullish view, just the idea that this is, we still have this parabolic phase of the market rise still ahead of us, and we're just basically throw valuations out the window and it's just going to go higher. So what was your takeaway from that interview?
Well, I think that Martin makes probably one of the more credible bull arguments that I've heard. Because honestly, with all due respect to others who may disagree with me, the folks that are saying the economy is rosy, everything is fine, there's no reason to be worried about the fact that this whole rally was driven by central bank liquidity, and you know it's all just a rosy economic picture and everything is fundamentally bullish. I think that's crazy, frankly. But Martin Armstrong, very notably, did not disagree with me to say that he thinks the market is overvalued. But what he's saying, and it makes perfect sense, is you still haven't seen any significant retail participation. How can the market crash when you don't have retail investors to panic and all get out at the same time and cause that crash? And if you look historically, the smart money is usually starting to get out of the market as retail is piling in. And as he points out, it is possible to see really big moves to the upside as the least sophisticated investors are piling into the market. I just saw a piece on Zero Hedge this week saying that we're starting to see some of the discount brokers reporting huge increases in new account openings. That could be the beginning of that final phase of the bull market. Now, the thing is, I think there's also a counter argument to this, which is we are in uncharted waters here in unprecedented times. And if we get to the point where confidence in central banks collapses, you know, you could see institutional investors panicking and all getting out at the same time. So I don't quite buy the argument that you can't have a crash unless there's retail participation. So the immature and unsophisticated investors all have to be the ones to do the panicking. I think there's room to panic for other reasons. I also agree with his view that when there's a real top, you usually don't get four or five or six chances, as we've seen in this market, to trade within 10 points of that. Usually it's a blow off and it's a really sudden reversal to the downside. So I think that we probably do have further to go. Doesn't make me want to be long this market, but it reminds me of why I don't want to be short yet. But having said that, Patrick, I want to come back to something that I know that our Western Canada listeners in particular are going to be super interested in, which is your speaking tour that's coming up in May. Tell us what it's about, where you're going, what are you talking about, who's the audience, what's it all about?
All right. Well, thanks, Eric. Well, we have a great relationship with Michael Campbell out at Money Talks. And so we're going to go and do a little speaking tour. We're going to be speaking in Calgary and Vancouver on May 6th and May 7th. And so I'm going to be out there. We're going to be talking about everything from some of those key macro drivers that are going to push the next major macro trends. And we're going to look at where all we think that next big market moves are going to come. As well, one of the key themes we're going to have is talking about how to leverage your returns while hedging your risks. And so we're going to delve into some of the different strategies associated with that. Yeah, so anyone that wants to learn more, please visit our bigpicturetrading.com website and you can register right on the page.
Well, I'm jealous. I wish I was going to Vancouver. That's the best dim sum in North America as far as I'm concerned. And I want to move on now to our postgame segment because based on listener feedback, I think that where I'd like to take these postgame segments after our feature interview each week is to translate the views that our guests express about the economy and so forth into actual actionable trading strategies based on the lessons that you teach on macro trading at bigpicturetrading.com. So we can start doing that next week. We have Professor Steve Keen on. I'm sure he's going to have some fantastic views, so that'll give us plenty of ammunition to work with. But first, I think we need to share with our listeners the basic framework that you teach around macro investing. And you basically teach people at bigpicturetrading.com about five tenets of macro investing that your whole model is kind of based on. So let's go ahead and work through those five tenets today, and then we'll start applying them next week after Steve Keen's interview. Let's start with the first one, which is forecasting markets.
Well, first of all, Eric, I just want to give credit where it's due. Not all of these macro tenets are original to me. Some very smart people made these trading rules, but they're just so amazing, and it's so, you have to anchor yourself on some of these views. So the first one on forecasting is that saying that says the most reliable way to forecast the future is to understand the present. And I absolutely love this statement, because some people rely on technical analysis and just some buy or sell signal, green arrow up, a red arrow down, or they use some other model and try to trust some other person's opinion. But I find that the best way to forecast the market is just to seek to understand. And that's why I'm so happy to be a part of the show, because we have so many smart guests come out and share so many of their perspectives, and it helps build a base for understanding how the world is evolving.
Well, I couldn't agree more with you, Patrick. You definitely have to understand how markets behave and react, because it's not always based on what you would expect in terms of fundamentals and common sense. Let's move on to the next macro tenet that you teach at BigPictureTrading.com, which is investor behavior.
All right. Well, the second tenet is one of my favorites, and understanding the behavioral element of the market. And it goes in saying that the market is not made up of currencies, commodities, stocks, and bonds, but it's rather made up of investors, traders, and bankers making decisions about those currencies, commodities, stocks, and bonds. And what that does is it gives you that core of understanding that it's the way we make decisions in the markets influences each other. And I like to kind of think of it like a poker game. There's those people that come into a poker game and just calculate the probability of their hand. But then there's the other players that turn around and play the table. They look at how the other players are positioned. And no better example of that is when you looked at the massive short interest in treasury bonds that was built up at the start of the year. It became consensus that the bond market was going to crash. Everyone got short. But when everyone gets short the market, it allows, from a behavioral element, for everyone to get squeezed out of the trade, because it's a crowded trade. And so there's this behavioral element that we have to understand beyond just the fundamentals themselves.
And I would point out that, you know, traders, just like other people, have moods. When we saw the big sell-off in crude oil, for example, people got freaked out when Saudi Arabia abandoned its prior role as the swing producer. And, you know, we were just selling futures hand over fist, and oil could do nothing but go down. Then we somehow had this switch that got exhausted, and there was a change of mood where everybody felt like they were just looking for an excuse to turn bullish and to buy crude oil. And I think that's now playing out, and we're probably going to see it turn back the other way, but it hasn't happened yet. So assessing the mood of the market is just as important as assessing the mood of your spouse or date. Let's move on to, speaking of spouses and dates, your next tenet, which is irrational market moves.
Well, this is actually very relevant to the conversation that we had with Martin Armstrong, and it's the idea that the market has a tendency to play the role of the great humiliator, often being irrational for extended periods of time. And this is anchoring yourself on the basis that, look, you know what, the markets might be expensive, they might be very high, and someone might say rationally or logically it doesn't make sense for it to go higher. It won't stop the fact that it will go higher, because it's a liquidity event. Now, while the markets can behave incredibly irrationally, I always like to anchor myself on the belief that over the long term, over enough of a time horizon, the macro fundamentals will always win in the end. You'll always have a reversion to the mean, but it's always amazing how far and how long irrational markets can stay that way.
And I think that was an excellent point that Martin Armstrong made today, which is, look, all of the smart people that listen to Macro Voices every week see all of the risks and issues in these markets. Don't pay attention to what the smart people are doing. What we see is retail online brokers reporting record numbers of new accounts being opened by unsophisticated newbie retail investors. That's a sign of a bunch of irrational capital flow into the market, not out. And as much as it doesn't make sense to me, that is what's happening right now. And you've got to acknowledge that, rational or not, markets are going to stay irrational, as the old adage goes, longer than you can stay solvent. Let's move on to market liquidity, which is the fourth tenet that you teach.
Well, that's based upon liquidity. And it's, I always like to anchor myself on the idea that first prices are first and foremost a function of liquidity rather than fundamental value. It's this idea that it's really about the supply and demand. The market is this live auction of price discovery. And what you have is this period where so long as there's sufficient buyers, they could always go to a higher price. And so if you anchor yourself on fundamental value and say the stock is expensive or it can't go any farther, it always shocks you how much more it goes. And that is because liquidity is the driver, not fundamental value.
I could not possibly agree more, and I just want to emphasize that point because it's so important. All this nonsense that you hear from academic finance about how the efficient markets hypothesis assures that prices will be reflective of the true value of the asset because of efficient price discovery is nonsense. What makes prices go up is somebody's got money they want to put to work, and they're buying stuff. And what makes prices go down is people are not buying stuff. They're selling stuff because they're trying to raise cash. What causes them to do that, if you really understand what's driven this huge bull market of the last 8 years, it's because we have trillions of dollars of central bank supplied liquidity. That money has to find a home, and it's finding its home in asset markets. So liquidity is just super important. Let's move on, though, before we run out of time, to market consensus, which is the fifth and final tenet that you teach at bigpicturetrading.com.
And this one is paraphrased from the trading legend Bob Farrell. And what it basically is that when all experts and forecasts are in consensus, something different is likely to happen. And I love anchoring myself on this because when you listen to the media and you see what's the hot story, what you often are already in this big herd of people chasing one storyline. No better example of that is the reflation trade at the tail end of the year. You know, and if you look at the reflation trade that was happening, you look year to date, from January to date, most of those reflation trades are either underwater or just barely profitable. And so when something was in consensus, it really stopped working as effectively as everyone thought it would.
And I think it's important to describe the mechanism for why that's true. When everybody agrees on something, on anything, they're going to be positioned for that. If they all agree that the market is going up, they're going to buy whatever they've got capital available to buy. Once they've done that, all the buyers are gone. They've already made their investment, and that means that the price can only go down because there's nobody left to do any buying. So whenever you get to that situation of everybody agreeing, you know that the opposite has to happen, and it's very important for investors to understand that. Unfortunately, we are out of time for this week's segment. What we're going to do starting next week is to apply these tenets and ask Patrick to help us to develop tradable strategies based on what our guests tell us during the feature interview. We'll begin that next week when we've got Professor Steve Keen lined up. Meanwhile, I'm going to go back to, you've heard it before, folks, but it's so important. We need your help promoting the program. Please retweet us when we announce the show. Forward your research roundup email to your friends and colleagues. Put the Macro Voices player on your website. And most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com. The more registered users we have, the more able Patrick is to get these really incredible guests. And boy, he's got some fantastic ones lined up in coming weeks. So you really can help us out by registering a free account at macrovoices.com. The direct benefit to you is you'll receive our free research roundup email, which never contains advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all of the coolest free stuff that we could find on the internet each week. Patrick, what's in this week's research roundup?
Well, first off, you're going to find the link to the transcript for today's interview with Martin Armstrong. In addition to that, there's a link to a listener-submitted article titled dollar doldrums, making an alternative case for the U.S. dollar. I mean, we've had so many U.S. dollar bull stories here. I just wanted to make sure to highlight one that gives a different alternative opinion. As well, there's a link to an article from the South China Morning Post talking about China's credit excess is unlike anything the world has ever seen. In addition to that, there's a link to a Financial Post article discussing the crash of Home Capital Group shares, one of the largest independent mortgage brokers in Canada. And this is a story I actually really want to talk more about next week, because I know Steve Keen has always some opinions on this. And I really want to spend some of the post game talking about what's going on in the markets over here, because obviously I'm from Toronto. And so I'm right in the epicenter of some of the craziest real estate price action that I've ever seen. You will find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share the content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. Now, if you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com. And we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.